Hi, my name is Juice. All right, not really. But for the purposes of this podcast, that's what I'm called. For 5 years, I wrote a blog called Tales from the Library. It was a chronicle of the nutty crap that happened to me as a small-town Appalachian library employee. For the past 2 years, I have hosted this very podcast to adapt my favorite stories from that blog. And now it's time to stop. This is the final episode of Tales from the Library Cast. Dateline, Friday, May 30th, 2008. Barbie T., future resident loon? On Friday, I received a telephone call from Barbara Turdmerkel asking if her Sue Grafton book was on hold. I took this to mean that she was asking if it was still on hold from the last time that I spoke to her, that time when she nearly took refuge in our building from an alleged windstorm that never came, a fate I only managed to avoid because I told her it was closing time. That was some time back, so I explained to her that we had likely shelved her hold for S is for Silence.
"Oh no, I picked that up, but I'd already read it," she said.
She wanted the next one, which I informed her again was T is for Trespass. Curiously, we had a copy of this very book in the hold bin. Even more curiously, the post-it on it said that it was for Barbie T. "We have that holding for you here," I said.
"But no one ever called me," she said.
I again consulted her hold slip, though, and noted that it said her phone had been disconnected and that we'd sent her a postcard, as per our policy. I explained this.
"But my phone isn't disconnected."
She then gave me her number. Turns out we had it wrong in our system somehow, off by one digit in the prefix. Then Barbie T said the words that sent chills down my spine.
"I'll come right up to get it."
I immediately went around and warned all of the staff as to her impending arrival. True to her threat, she turned up a half hour later, though I didn't notice her at first. Mrs. B told me that Barbie T had come in for her book, rooted around in her wallet for her card for a while, had trouble finding it, paused her search momentarily to show Mrs. B pictures of herself from back in the days when she was young and pretty and not so crazy. Photos Mrs. B has seen many times before. Then eventually Barbara found her card and checked out her book. Soon after, she disappeared, and we both assumed she had left the building. Instead, she had actually browsed a bit before settling into one of the comfy chairs by the front window. I even glanced at her on a couple of occasions during the course of half an hour, but didn't recognize her at all. I still have no idea what it is about Barbara Turdmerkel that my memory cannot seem to hold her in place, either by sight or by sound, for very long at all. I'd previously assumed that this was because our encounters with her are simply so infrequent, but this time I believe there was something else at play. Though I didn't actually get a good and direct look at her until later, my casual glances at her presence registered her appearance in my brain as that of a young woman, despite the presence of her cane. And again, without looking directly at her, I even wondered to myself what kind of tragedy this young woman could have experienced that had caused her to have to use such a cane. Not until later, when she came to the desk and produced her card, did I realize who she was, even though I knew she had been in the building. After her true identity had been revealed, I finally got a proper look at her, and could see that Barbie T was camouflaged in an outfit that belied her actual age. She was dressed in a clean t-shirt and jeans, and her hair was cut short and stylishly, taking years off her appearance. I dare say she even looked nice, though I would never ever tell her that for fear of giving her the kind of attention I imagine she craves, endangering more frequent visits.
"It's really nice here," Barbie T said. "It's very relaxing," she added. "It's a nice place just to sit and read," she suggested. "I should come here more often just to sit and read," she threatened.
I had absolutely nothing to offer on this topic, nothing I could say out loud anyway. The thought of Barbara Turdmerkel spending hours and hours of her time, not to mention hours and hours of our time, hanging out at the library is indeed a chilling one. and she would never use that time to simply sit and read. No, she would find every excuse to come to the desk to talk to the staff, to get some sort of human interaction that I imagine her life is in no doubt lacking. Unfortunately, we have way too much of that kind of thing in our lives to begin with, being as how we deal with the insane all the time already. And having Barbie T's particular brand of it on a regular basis was not something we wanted any part of. With this in mind, nothing occurred to me that I could say that would not accidentally encourage her. So I kept my trap shut. Granted, I won't be on the job for much longer, in case she truly decides to attach herself remora-like to our hide. But for the sake of my friends on staff, I pray that she doesn't. Dateline, Monday, November 19th, 2007. Library Glossary. Basket cases. Basket cases. Noun, plural. 1. Mentally unstable or otherwise crazy patrons. 2. Patron parents, often with multiple children, who check out the full available limit in books on each of their children's cards, their own card, and often on the linked cards of non-present family members. They do this in the mistaken belief that this will somehow keep their brood occupied reading for the longest possible amount of time, freeing that parent from having to entertain or otherwise deal with them or turn on the TV. The name for this type of patron stems from their habit of hauling away the dozens of selections their children have made in very large wicker baskets or, alternately, colorfully painted wash tubs. This is actually all right with us, for we do like those kind of circulation numbers. The only trouble is, basket cases very often accomplish these mass checkouts, which can take upwards of 5 minutes for our staff to accomplish, on story hour day, which is when the desk is overrun with other basket case families doing exactly the same thing, creating a giant basket case glut. And because massive amounts of books are difficult to keep up with in the best of circumstances, basket cases are perpetually in hoc to the library for overdue books. Often they insist that they return said books and raise a stink about it and check our shelves to no avail, only to find the books hidden away at home months later. Because of their perpetual indebtedness, basket cases often insist on returning their books on Fridays, a day on which our branch traditionally does not charge fines. This would be perfectly acceptable to us, except that basket cases almost always insist on returning their hordes of books at approximately 5 minutes before closing time. And because it's never simply one basket case family that does this, the Friday closing staff member present, i.e., usually me, always has to spend an unnecessary amount of time shelving all those goddamn books after closing, and is always late for his dinner. See also Bag People. Dateline, Friday, July 4th, 2008. Final Friday. My final week on the job has officially begun. My last day will be next Thursday, so today is my final Friday as a library ass. Fridays are usually very busy at the library, even nigh unto as busy as a Monday. However, we usually have enough staff on Fridays to carry the load at least until 5 p.m. when everyone abandons the official Friday closer and flees to their weekends 2 hours earlier than I get to. Fridays are also especially busy because it's our weekly amnesty day, and it's when all the basket cases bring in their kids' long overdue books to turn in for free, glutting the book cart even beyond the usual busy Friday turn-in. Now, as an experienced Friday closer myself, I know that it's imperative to getting that book cart cleared out before 5 p.m., because after 5, shelving becomes problematic with no one else to run the desk for you. Imagine my horror, therefore, at arriving today to find every single shelf of the book cart not only completely packed, but completely packed with other books laying on top of the packed books, and then stacks of books laying on the nearby circ desk itself. I very nearly said, sorry, but no, I'm done. Mrs. B. explained that because of our new nonfiction section recently overgrowing to the point that it has begun encroaching on the territory of the mystery fiction, Mrs. A. had told Mrs. J. to go through every book in new nonfiction and remove the ones with any 2007 stamps as the first stamp in the date due slip. Mrs. A. said that she and Mrs. C. would then go through these books and decide what they wanted to put back in new nonfiction and what they wanted to shelve in the stacks. Trouble was, it had been quite a while since they had had Mrs. J. do that, and neither of the bosses was coming over to sort through any of it. Meanwhile, the usual Friday crowd was still turning in all their books, which were the ones piling up on the desk. And meanwhile, Mrs. C. was in her office furiously cataloging stacks of new books to process, which would have to be put out as well. And as the guy who would likely have to wind up processing all these new books, this disturbed me greatly. I wanted to tell her, "No! Stop making work for me! I've got plenty up there as it stands! Please, come and look through some of the nonfiction so I can start making a dent in this pile that's already there, because it ain't like the Friday crowd incoming books are slowing down anytime soon." Instead, I said a far more respectful and polite version of the above, and eventually Mrs. C. came and went through the nonfiction on the cart, allowing me and Mrs. J. to finally start shelving some of it. The remainder of my final Friday passed with little incident. Dateline, Monday, July 7th, 2008. Final Monday. While at lunch with the wife today, I mentioned that this was the final Monday I would be working at the library. She asked if I was saddened by this fact. "Not even a little bit," I told her. "'Cause, as has been well chronicled here over the past 5 years, I hates me a Monday." What could I possibly miss about Mondays at the library? The incessant banging on and repeated trying of the handles of the doors to see if we're open before 1 p.m., despite the obvious sign clearly stating otherwise? Gone from my life. The annoyed expressions on those patrons who've been trying the doors when we do at last unlock them at 1 p.m.? Gone from my life. The mad rushes by internet crowders to get to the computers before they all fill up? Gone from my life. The endless procession of extraordinarily needy patrons, many of whom have questions that can only be answered by a person of authority, on a day when people in authority are never present? Gone from my life. Long-time internet crowders who have used the computers nearly every single day for the past couple of years and yet still cannot get it through their heads that we close at 5 on Mondays, and who act all shocked and amazed each and every week when we tell them they don't actually have another 4 hours at their disposal, but they have to get off in 10 minutes? Or the internet patrons who walk into the building at 10 till 5 with the same expectations and literally smack themselves in the forehead because once again their poor Swiss cheese memory has failed them? Gone from my life. As Mondays go, though, today was actually not terribly problematic. Sure, we had the usual Monday madness, but not infuriatingly so. I tried to just go with the flow and live in the moment and enjoy it as much as I could. The major incident of the day came around 4 p.m. when one of our computer patrons tripped and fell while trying to walk across a level section of floor. In this man's defense, he had suffered a stroke a while back and does walk with a pronounced limp. I had just asked him to relinquish his computer for a new patron, and he had just been in the process of walking toward the circ desk to sign up for another session when he fell. I was looking right at him when he dropped like a sack of dead wet marmosets, but with the massive circ desk separating us, I was powerless to do anything about it beyond giving off a sympathetic yelp. He fell hard, too, right on his arm, and I was pretty sure it was going to be broken or dislocated or otherwise in need of an ambulance. I rushed around the desk and over to where the man had fallen. Mr. B. Natural, who had been seated at the computer directly beside the place where the man had fallen, also rushed over. The man was writhing on the floor, clutching at his arm. Quite intelligently, I asked, "Are you all right?" The man looked up at me and then at Mr. B. Natural and, through a very painful-looking expression, said he was indeed all right. Mr. B. Natural began trying to help him sit up, but the man waved him off, saying, "I'm all right, I'm all right."
"Well, here's your glasses," Mr. B. said, gathering them up and handing them over.
"I'll get them, I'm all right," the man said.
"Well, here's your hat,"
Mr. B. Natural added.
"I'll get them, I'm all right," the man said, now practically screaming. "Please, I'm all right, I'll get them."
"Can I help you up?" I asked.
"No, I'm all right."
The more we tried to help, the angrier the man became. But it felt wrong not trying to help him, particularly with everyone across the main floor staring at us. I think, though, that the attention being directed at him was the actual problem. The man was embarrassed at having fallen and didn't want any more attention than he'd already attracted. Slowly, Mr. B. Natural and I backed away, but not too far. This was actually good, because as soon as the man had slowly clambered to his feet, he tipped over again, and Mr. B. Natural was near enough to catch him.
"I'm all right," the man hissed as Mr. B. Natural set him upright again. "I'll be fine as soon as I can sit down for a minute," the man said.
Then, as though he needed further explanation for being annoyed with us, he added,
"The physical therapists say that it helps to do everything for myself."
"Do you need a chair?" I offered, looking for the nearest one.
"No, I am all right. I'm all right. I'll get it. I'll be fine."
So I walked away, and the man hobbled over to the circ desk and leaned there for a moment. He left his hat and glasses there, then hobbled back over to Mr. B. Natural to apologize for being so gruff. I thought, if only you knew you were apologizing to the grumpiest old man in all the world, dude. Then the man hobbled off to the bathroom, where he stayed in a seated position, if you get my drift, for quite a while. Dateline, Tuesday, July 8th, 2008. Final Tuesday. My final Tuesday was largely uneventful, save for one curious incident. Mid-afternoon, a fairly stunning college-aged girl approached the desk. She grinned broadly at me and said, "Hi, how's it going?" in a very familiar tone. She looked familiar, too, but I couldn't place her. The girl turned in a book, I checked it in, and noted that her last name was also familiar, though the first name listed was actually her mother's. That's when I realized that this girl was the daughter of a patron I also know from church. Oh, so that's where I know her from, I thought. I probably just recognized her from church from back when she was still a high school student. Now she was off to college and home for the summer. It was only later, after she came to check out, that I realized the full nature of her identity. She passed me a book and then her library card. When I scanned the card, though, it brought up her mother's record again. The girl then mentioned that her own card was linked to her mother's card, so if I wanted to use her real card instead, I could do that. I switched over to the linked patrons tab and saw her first name. Then it hit me. This was no mere girl I knew from church. This was Miss K, our former newbie greenhorn, formerly high school-aged weekend warrior, who had originally been hired to replace the thieving, dishonest, and job-abandoning Miss E. Wow, did she grow up! I later suggested to Mrs. C that if they needed a quick replacement for me, at least for the summer, they could do far worse than hire Miss K again. She's already partially trained, or at least far more so than most newbie greenhorns off the street would be. Now if only Miss E, Miss S, Miss Temp, Miss F, Mrs. H, and Miss Night Ranger would come by for a visit, it would be just like old home week at the library. Dateline, Wednesday, July 9th, 2008. Final Wednesday. One of our faithful weekly patrons is a guy called Jeff. I don't know much about Jeff other than he's some sort of skilled laborer, a carpenter, I'm imagining. He is also the owner and wearer of a ZZ Top beard and a train engineer-style hat. He visits us every Wednesday at around 5 p.m. like clockwork, and he has pretty good taste in reading material. I know this last bit because I helped shape a minor corner of his taste in books by introducing him to the works of Neil Gaiman. The way this began is that, years back, Jeff asked me for a recommendation on a book. As is usually the case when people ask me this, I shoved good omens at him. He liked it quite a bit, so the next week it was Neverwhere, then American Gods, then an interlibrary loan for Stardust, which I'm proud to say we now own, and then Smoke and Mirrors, Coraline, Wolves in the Walls, and eventually Anansi Boys. M is for Magic is the latest Neil Gaiman collection we have, though we also recently picked up the ever-so-excellent unabridged audio adaptation of Neverwhere, as read by Neil himself. And I must confess, the man is now right up there with Jim Dale as far as audio readers go in my book. Oddly, I don't think I've ever mentioned The Sandman to Jeff, which is criminal, really. However, we only have the first couple of trades of that series, so it's always seemed needlessly cruel to get him addicted just to say, "Oh, so sorry, we don't have any more for you." But the rest of it is really good. So Jeff occasionally asks me what sort of thing Neil has coming out next. I recently reported to him of Neil's new children's book, Odd and the Frost Giants, as well as the Graveyard book, which will be coming out in the year. Meanwhile, he's branched out quite a bit and reads all sorts of other good things, including Gene Wolfe, who's a favorite author of Neil's, and naturally Douglas Adams, who is the author that first led me to read Neil via Neil's Hitchhiker's Guide biography, Don't Panic. Funny story, that. When Neil first began writing comic books in this country, one of his earliest efforts for DC in the late 1980s was the Black Orchid miniseries. I'd always liked the character Black Orchid, having read of her in Suicide Squad and the Who's Who directory of the DC Universe, and I really, really wanted to read this prestige format miniseries. Unfortunately, we did not yet have a comic shop in the town I grew up in, so I had to wait for the eventual trade. However, when I read the press about Black Orchid, I knew I recognized the name Neil Gaiman from something else that I owned. I just couldn't place what it was he'd written. So, I spent a good hour going through my entire comic book collection, looking for his name on every cover, trying to figure out why it was so damn familiar. Sitting there on the floor of my high school bedroom, I finished the last box of my then 2 or 3 long box collection and had not found anything by him. I felt defeated and allowed my head to fall back on my shoulders, which wound up aiming my gaze up at my bookshelf where I saw the name Neil Gaiman staring down at me from the spine of Don't Panic. Within a couple of years, I had the Black Orchid trade and began noticing Neil writing smaller stories in places such as the comic series Secret Origins, including a fantastic origin for Poison Ivy that I highly recommend, and I believe is collected in a Neil Miscellaneous Stories trade paperback put out a few years ago. When I heard he was doing a book called The Sandman, I wondered if this was a new version of either the Golden Age Wesley Dodd Sandman, whom I had read of in a story called Whatever Happened to the Sandman, which I believe was a backup tale in a 1985 issue of All-Star Squadron, which I also dearly loved, or if he was adapting the Jack Kirby 1973 Sandman wearing the red and yellow costume, which I oddly owned a couple of issues of, having special ordered them, thinking they were about the Golden Age Sandman. I liked them well enough. When my friend Gordon began buying the new Sandman book, though, I asked him which version of it it was. He wasn't familiar with either of the two previous characters, but said it didn't sound like them. He made me read a couple of issues of The Doll's House, though, and very quickly I found that Kirby Sandman did play a role. I was already hooked by then, though, on the story of Morpheus and, more importantly, the supporting cast of The Doll's House. And to me, Neil's Sandman is always more about the various supporting casts than the Sandman himself, and have spread this affection/infection to most of my friends. But I digress, with lots of parentheses. When Jeff turned up today, I broke the news that I was leaving, and would not likely see him next week, or perhaps for a long time. He congratulated me on the move, but then seemed concerned. "Where am I going to get my news about the next Neil books?" he asked. "Oh, I got 'em pretty well trained around here," I said. "If they see Neil's name on something, they'll order it." Dateline, Thursday, July 10th, 2008. Final Thursday. Final day. I arrived at work at 1 p.m. Except for Ms. M., everyone else had gone to lunch, and she was scheduled to leave as soon as I arrived. "So I guess I won't see you again," she said sadly. Oh, I'll be back, I said. I got some web work still to do here, so I'll probably be in next week. Plus, there's the matter of the going-away party that Mrs. A said she wants to throw, but which we still have to wait a couple of weeks for because she's out of town and I'm moving next week. The wife will still be in the area through the end of the month, so it won't be any big deal for me to pop on over. Soon, Ms. D returned from lunch. She brought me a bag of coffee beans from one of our local coffee shops. I asked the guy if he knew you and what kind of coffee you liked, Ms. D said. He said he knew you, but he had no idea on the coffee, so I got you house blend. It's perfect, I said. The rest of my final day on the job went fairly smoothly, with cameos by some classic characters from the blog. The bakers put in an early appearance, and I told them it was my final day. They were happy for the wife's opportunity in Borderland, but sad to see me go. I'll miss them, too. The kids have all practically grown up in the 7 years I've been at the library. Oldest daughter Catherine is off to college. Middle child Brianna has changed from being a whiny, indecisive middle schooler and has blossomed into quite a stunning young lady. And next time I see little Olive, she'll probably be driving. Mr. B. Natural came in a couple of times. The computers were glutted on his first visit, but he was able to negotiate with Gene Gene the genealogy machine for the use of Gene's computer for 5 minutes, just to check something, he said. Of course, Gene's intense desire for internet suckling only lasted about 3 minutes before he decided he would just leave the building because Mr. B. Natural was taking way too long. Later, Gene. Not gonna miss ya. Not long after, two members of my other all-time favorite family, the Asners, came in to pay for a fine and renew a book. It didn't occur to me in the moment, but I really should have told them that they were my favorite library family. I've actually told them as much in the past, mentioning that they were a pleasure to deal with each and every time I saw them, but it would have been a nice parting to mention it again. Mid-afternoon, Mrs. C, Mrs. B, and Ms. D made an excuse to head downstairs to our multi-purpose room, and soon returned from the staff break room with a giant cheesecake variety pack. "You didn't think we were letting you get out of here without some sort of celebration, did you?" Mrs. C asked. "This is awesome," I said. "Thanks." And it was quite awesome cheesecake. We all feasted heartily. The afternoon saw further cameos from the usual internet crowd, including Mr. W. Perfect, Cleveland, the Hacker Family, Old Man Printer, and Germaphobe Gary, who didn't even ask me for a Clorox wipe. I was really hoping for an appearance by Captain Crossdresser, or maybe even the Ghost of the Purple Nun, but at least Parka didn't show up. And toward the end of the day, another long-lost library family member turned up in the form of Riff, the formerly high school-aged homeschool kid who used to hang out in the library with his sister Magenta. Riff's now a junior in college studying sports management. His sister Magenta graduated college this past year. My duties today include checking shelves for overdues one last time, folding up and preparing the overdues for mailing one last time, stuffing fund drive envelopes one last time, processing new magazines one last time, and rearranging those magazines in our magazine shelf, which is, as always, plagued on a daily basis by people who have no concept of putting periodicals back where they are clearly labeled to belong, instead of cramming them in at random. My final check-in of the day was The Calder Game by Blue Balliet, checked out by my writer friend Linda. Before I clocked out, I took all of my remaining red shelving slips and pinned them to the staff bulletin board with a note that read, "This color is now retired." I then gathered up my satchel and my toiletries, including toothbrush, toothpaste, bottle of Cetaphil, hair gunk, mouthwash, defunk, etc., from my locker in the staff workroom. I then affixed to my bag my locker's mini Post-it label of Juice 2 Belts. If you don't know what that means, just check out the Dumbass Things I've Done podcast for the story. I grabbed the remainder of my cheesecake and headed out the staff workroom door toward my car. On my way out, I noticed that I'd left my pot of hens and chicks by the back door. I thought about returning to go get them, but I can catch them next time. I'm not done with this place yet. Dateline, Friday, November 21st, 2008. The Indie Bit, a.k.a. Actual Conversations Heard in Actual Libraries, number 141. Setting,
my former library. I had cause to pay a visit to the Tri-Metro area recently, so I popped by the library to see everybody. The last few times I've been in, I've only seen Mrs. B, Mrs. D, and Miss Temp. But this time, nearly everybody was in-house, including former bosses Mrs. A and Mrs. C. They're all doing fine and wanted to hear the latest news from me. While I was there, Mr. B Natural came in and signed up for a computer, then noticed me standing at the circ desk.
Hey, you're back!
Only temporarily.
What? You're not working here again?
Nope, I moved to Borderland.
How come?
My wife got a job there.
I need to get me a wife who has a job.
We stood there for a few moments as I finished up what I was doing at the desk, and Mr. B waited for Miss Temp to finish helping another patron and come log him onto a computer. Mr. B Natural turns to me.
Hey, you want to put me on one of these for old time's sake?
Yeah, sure.
They hadn't even changed the password.
The Indie Bit. And thus we reach the end of our run on Tales from the Library Cast. As I said in the final entry of today's episode, my wife and I moved away from Tri-Metro and set up shop in the town I came to call Borderland. And for a while after we moved, I continued to blog on Tales from the Library. However, without a rogues gallery to draw from, not to mention any kind of daily contact with the general public, I had to turn to more mundane subject matter for material. I covered topics like my multiple battles with telemarketers, people who park like assholes at Walmart, and my many misadventures as a new dog owner, not to mention new homeowner. In fact, a goodly chunk of the blog's output became a chronicle of our difficulties with home improvement projects. But it went... After a while, though, I decided it felt wrong to continue to write about non-library topics on a library blog. So shortly after the 5th anniversary of the beginning of the Tales from the Library blog, I moved shop to a new home called BorderlandTales.blogspot.com. With a few gaps, some of which lasted several months, the blog served as a chronicle of life for nearly 4 years that we were in Borderland up until we moved back to Tri-Metro. There you can find more telemarketer battles, more Walmart asshole parkers, some tragedies involving pets, skirmishes with a local car dealership, including a near-month-long stint in which they had possession of my vehicle after it kissed a boulder coming down the icy hills of our steep-ass, blind-curve-riddled neighborhood. Got out of jury duty doing that one. However, I haven't written anything at Borderland Tales since wrapping up the huge, multi-month saga in which I did mighty battle with Suddenlink Cable over whether or not they were going to give me internet service at our new house back here in Tri-Metro. They kind of won that one. So I guess while I'm going around ending things like podcasts, I probably ought to step back over to the blog and write something final there, too. Most of this episode has been recorded, edited, and in the can for weeks now, but I've been sitting on it so I could put out a few of the specials in the mix, such as the Biz Girl interview special and the two B-sides and rarity specials, not to mention this past week of best of episodes. Interestingly, if I had just aired this final episode where it should have fallen in the proper order, I would have missed out on being able to tell you an interesting coda to both the blog and the podcast. Last week, while out mowing the lawn, the episode of Jordan Jesse Go that I happened to be enjoying in my phone's headphones was rudely interrupted by an actual telephone call. Who should be on the other end but one of my former bosses at the library, Mrs. C. Mrs. C. asked how I was doing, made some small talk, and then asked me if I had any interest at all in coming back to work for the library on a part-time and temporary basis. Yeah, I was floored too. She explained that my former fellow employee and former multi-year newbie greenhorn, Ms. M., was going to be out for a month or so due to the fact that at some point in the recent past, one of her heel bones had evidently exploded, she'd walked around on it for several weeks, and then developed a staph infection that caused her to be hospitalized. This, I should add, is the same person who once fractured one of her legs in two places after stepping in a hole. Her ordeal does indeed sound awful, and we're all curious, as I'm sure she is as well, to learn how exactly her heel exploded. But the long short of it is, she can't come back to work for at least another month and a half, and the library is in need of someone to fill in. I was immediately excited for this prospect. I mean, the idea of getting to go back to my former life as a library ninja, even on just a temporary basis, and to once again be able to blog about the experience was simply golden. What a great bookend to both the podcast and the blog. I mean, just the learning curve of having to relearn all the shit I used to know by heart would be funny enough. I would, for all intents and purposes, become a newbie greenhorn myself. It would be a time for me to get a taste of my own medicine after all those entries I wrote making fun of Ms. M. and Ms. S. for their ineptitude during their many years as greenhorns. Plus, this job would also put me in a position to see a bunch of the old rogue patrons, do some updates on what they're doing these days. Okay, sure, it's probably the same shit they were doing 5 years ago, but at least it would be new shit to report on. The job, as Mrs. C. explained it, would only be for a couple of days a week, which I thought I might even be able to fit into my schedule. However, even as I talked to Mrs. C., a voice in my head was screaming at me that I should not agree too quickly. You see, I'm seriously frickin' busy these days with some freelance writing work, which is partially the reason that I'm having to end this podcast. In fact, I'm procrastinating on working on a job to write and record these words even now, and it's a lucrative one, so you guys owe me. In fact, you should go right now and buy some shit at Amazon and do it through the click-through banner on librarycast.com, damn it. So instead of agreeing, I told Mrs. C. I would have to get back to her in a couple of days. After I mowed for a bit more, I remembered something that made my heart sink. See, in addition to all this pay-in freelance work that's taken up a huge chunk of my time, I also have an acting job that starts this month, which will run through the end of June. My ability to do anything beyond either writing or performing is going to be seriously compromised in the very near future, which is great for my wallet, but not so great as for my free time. I don't even know what my schedule is going to be for the next 2 weeks, so I couldn't exactly agree to a time that I could spare 4 of those days to work at the library on top of everything else. I had to write Mrs. C. back and decline this grand return to the library. It really, really hurt my blogger soul to have to decline this, but to agree to it would be madness with all of my other commitments. Even the time freed up by ending this podcast is already spoken for. And so, a long-lost chapter that I didn't even know could be written will have to exist only in some parallel universe where I have 1 or 2 less jobs in my life. Huh, sounds like a nice place to visit. I wonder if I have facial hair in that mirror universe. Speaking of endings, I've had an absolute metric shit ton of fun producing this show for the past 2 years, but it is indeed time to close up shop on this chapter in my podcasting career. As I've said before, I spent 5 years chronicling my job in Tales from the Library's original blog, and then I've spent the past 2 years adapting some of those entries into podcast form. But the actual job the blog and podcast was based on ended nearly 5 years ago to the day this episode drops. Sure, there are still hundreds of blog entries I could adapt, and it would be a lot of fun to do more of them. But there comes a time when one has to move forward instead of continually looking backward. All right, I do reserve the right to produce future special episodes should I happen to stumble on any old unadapted entries that just burn my soul to be produced. But those specials will be rare if they happen at all. I guess it still would be a good reason to keep the RSS feed of this podcast in your feed aggregator and my Twitter account at LibraryCast befriended. So while I'm too busy to continue doing a weekly podcast, I am working on a less frequent one. My buddies Glenn and Joe have agreed to jump into a new podcasting venture with me in which we'll try to fill in some of the gaping holes in our cinematic education. See, I recently came to the realization that among the thousands of movies that I've never seen, there are several hundred of allegedly touchstone films that seemingly everyone else in the world has seen, but which somehow have never made it into my eye holes. Glenn and Joe have much the same experience. So we've compiled a huge list of films that we've not seen individually, and another list of those we've not seen collectively. We're going to spend some time seeking these films out, often at random. Watch them and come together to spread the good word on the experience. Listeners will be invited to play along as well, because at the end of each episode, we'll spin the roulette wheel of cinematic gaps to determine our next film to watch. That way, you can go and watch it too, and not have any of it spoiled for you when you next listen. And while Glenn and Joe are terrified of the prospect, we're going to throw a few movie grenades into the randomizer as well, which means that for every 5 or so on the waterfronts we have in there, there's going to be an Encino Man whammy or two. At the end of the day, this is basically just an excuse for the 3 of us to hang out and shoot the shit, but if we can manage to expand our movie horizons as well as that of the listeners at the same time, all the better. So that's another good reason to keep the RSS feed for this podcast in your aggregator queue, because I'll be posting the backdoor pilot of our new show here before moving it to its own site. And now, it is time for one last favorite podcast of the week. My final favorite podcast of the week, at least until I'm joined by Joe and Glenn for our own favorite things of the week segment, is Dan Harmon's podcast, Harmontown. Dan Harmon, for those of you who don't know, is the name of the guy who created the TV show Community. He was recently and unceremoniously fired from that show just before the new season began filming. So far, I've managed not to watch a single non-Harmon episode of the show, though this is not so much out of choice as I've just simply not finished watching last season's episodes. DVRs have made me lazy. Harmon's one of my favorite people, though. And he's busy working on a new animated show for Adult Swim via his Starburns Productions empire. Anyway, I wasn't even aware that he had a podcast called Harmontown until a couple of months back, when he guest-starred on Duncan Trussell's podcast, The Duncan Trussell Family Hour. Since then, I've listened to 5 or 6 Harmontown episodes, and I really, really like it. Each week, Mayor Dan Harmon hits the stage at the Meltdown Theater in Los Angeles, where he makes chatty with his sidekick-slash-comptroller Jeff Davis, plus members of the audience. Usually there are a few celebrity guests as well, such as recent appearances by Robin Williams and Bobcat Goldthwait. Then at about the halfway mark, Dan and his cohorts, including his girlfriend and a few other regulars, such as comedian Kumail Nanjiani, come together to play Dungeons & Dragons before the live audience. I gotta say that, on paper, nothing sounds more boring to me than listening to grown-ass adults play D&D. Kevin Smith and some of his friends tried a podcast like that a while back, and I just found it unlistenable. However, Harmontown's version has slowly won me over. They're still playing a serious game of D&D with all the rules that go with it, but they're not taking themselves very seriously while doing so. I'm still mainly interested in the first half of the show, but if I don't have something else pressing going on, I'll stick around for the gaming too. Check it out for yourself at harmontown.com or via the link at librarycast.com. Before I sign off for good, I feel like I ought to say thanks to a few people who've been especially supportive of the show over the past 2 years. My listeners may not number in the thousands, but they do seem to be a pretty loyal bunch. Thanks go out to Evan Band of the Band Library Podcast, Anna Brynoff, who can be found at Brynoff on Twitter, Phil Catalanet, my friend in New York City, who was a major fan of the blog as well, and of course my buddies Glenn and Joe, who are probably my ideal audience members and are the guys I've been trying to write for since starting the blog in 2003. Sure, I tend to write what makes me laugh, but that's because I tend to laugh at the same things I know Glenn and Joe are going to find funny. I guess in many respects, they're kind of my collective muse. Since starting the podcast, it's been interesting to hear from them. The difference between the way they imagined the voices of the characters from the blog would sound and the voices I've actually given them here. I'd also like to take the time to thank the most important person in my life, my goodly wife, Ashley. She has been a remarkably patient soul with my anal retentive need to get a new podcast out each week, not to mention the amount of time it often takes to do that. I know it has not always been easy for her, nor without irritation, but she's never said a cross word about it. The funny thing is, I'd always planned that if I ever had a week when I was too sick to do a podcast, I would just have her sub for me, since she usually finds the stuff I write funny and loves to read it aloud. I've actually done readings where I've just let her take the mic. Of course, sometimes her reaction to the material found here has been something like, "You said what about Nicolette Sheridan?" But she's also been the one to cry with laughter over the part she finds funny. especially the parts in which she's able to guess her birthday and or anniversary surprise in advance. I love you, babe. I would also be remiss if I did not thank Mr. Joel Hunger, the composer of the show's theme music. Joel is a gentleman who I have never actually met and or communicated with. But you can license his prolific output of music just like I did from a variety of sound sites, including pond5.com and joelhunger.com. I've only recently discovered that he has a Twitter account, so you can find him there too, at jhungermusic. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. Keep watching the podcast website, librarycast.com, for news of my future endeavors. Or follow me on Twitter, at librarycast. Until next time, just remember, the library loves you, but only if you had a good time while it lasted.
Well, here's your glasses, Mr. B said.
Having to do Mr. B Natural's voice anymore? Gone from my life.